used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. Today is Friday, August the 17th, 2018. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Elise Jacobson.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us today, Elise. The theme of today's show centers on micro sanctuaries and the power of animal advocacy through rescue and providing a home for animals using the resources you already have. For our first interview today, we'll have Rocky Schwartz on the show, who lives in Brooklyn, New York, with her rescued dog, chicken, and fish companions. She is a board director of the Micro Sanctuary Movement, an initiative to help people rescue and care for farmed animals who are normally seen as nothing more than commodities. This centers on a radical revisioning of the term sanctuary on a grassroots level. Rocky will be here today to tell us more about the concept and how you can start your own micro sanctuary. Then we'll have Ryan Phillips on the show for an activist profile. Ryan lives in Williamsburg, Virginia, with his three pigs, a chicken, a bunny, a dog, and some humans in a condo. He is living the micro sanctuary life and works nonstop as a full-time animal activist, most prominently having members of the public meet his companion animals and be forever transformed in the way that they view beings and their food. Ryan will tell us about his life's work in advocating relentlessly to change hearts and minds. That interview is coming up in 25 minutes, so please do stay tuned. And because we have such a packed show today, Elise, you're going to start with some news stories for us that have been happening in the past week or so.
That's right. So to start, all vegan organization London Vegan Food Bank just recently opened in Canada. The London, Ontario Food Bank was founded by Cassidy Jordan and Brennan Moore with the mission of making plant-based foods, particularly fresh fruit and vegetables, accessible to all Canadians. Cassidy Jordan told CBC News, there's definitely a need at the regular food banks who do great work. They don't actually have 100% plant-based donation boxes available. A lot of people who might be in a position to use the food bank and follow a vegan diet are out of luck, unquote. The food bank is supplied by donations from local companies and Canadian farms, and in addition to fresh produce, offers users vegan muffins, plant-based milk, pasta, bagels, and Oreos, which the bank ships to Canadians in need. The duo plan to open a Pay What You Wish store in the future with expanded vegan options. So I love that. I think that's awesome. Also, San Francisco-based food technology startup Clara Foods will debut a vegan egg white by the end of 2019. The company raised $1.75 million in investment capital to perfect its flagship product, which is made by brewing yeast and sugar in a lab-based setting to reproduce proteins found in egg whites without the use of chickens. Clara Foods CEO Arturo Elizondo said, I looked into how incredibly unsustainable animal agriculture is. It really blew my mind. There are more chickens in the U.S. than people, each confined to an area of a piece of paper and never seeing daylight. Light, unquote. Within the next year, the food industry will be augmented by companies that aim to replace traditional animal agriculture with new slaughter-free technologies. California startup Just, the company is called Just, recently debuted its mung bean-based egg replacer, Just Egg, and plans to debut slaughter-free chicken grown in a lab setting using a small amount of animal cells by the end of 2018. So that I find amazing as well. So many new innovations in plant-based food and cruelty-free food. And
yeah, as I was telling my coworkers last night at work, trying to veganize people, I said, there's a vegan alternative for everything.
It's so true.
Because she's like, yeah. Oh, my dairy and eggs, already vegetarian.
Right.
There's no need.
That's true. Yeah. And it's just getting easier and easier. There's so many innovations just constantly being developed. Also in the U.S., hundreds of plant-based doctors took to the White House to display a giant Ditch the Dairy sign in response to government plans to spend $50 million bailing out dairy farmers. The event was led by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a nonprofit with 12,000 doctor members. According to PCRM, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will funnel 13 million gallons of milk into federal food programs, that's cow's milk, such as the National School Lunch Program. And the stunt follows the organization testifying in support of a new American Medical Association resolution that could make it easier for the more than 30 million students who rely on the National School Lunch Program to receive an alternative to cow's milk back in June. So that's kind of cool. People making waves outside the White House, plant-based doctors. And last but not least, the city of Los Angeles is considering a ban on fur. In a city council meeting on August 15th this week, council members Paul Koretz, who chairs the Personnel and Animal Welfare Committee, and Bob Blumenfield successfully made an argument against the production and sale of fur in Los Angeles. They are proposing a 2-year phase-in period if an ordinance is passed. They will now go before the full city council, which will decide if the proposal should be sent to the city attorney's office to draft an ordinance, which will then need to be approved and signed by Mayor Eric Garcetti. And Allison, you were saying that this is the fourth city to
this would make it the fourth city. So we just, I mean, this was on the news earlier this year. San Francisco is banning fur. Yeah. So that was just several months ago. They're the third city. West Hollywood, I believe, or Berkeley. Those are the two first. Berkeley, California, and West Hollywood. And West Hollywood was several years ago. So what I think is that we're really on the precipice of something big that's going to happen here. It seems to be on the West Coast. So let's hope Vancouver's going to follow suit soon. And I really hope so, because we actually have a Canada Goose store that is set to arrive sometime in this next year.
That's true.
I would love for that to be banned.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the news. So for our first interview today, we have Rocky Schwartz on the show. She is a New York City-based rescuer, activist, and micro-sanctuary operator, as well as a board member of the nonprofit group called the Micro-Sanctuary Movement. The Micro-Sanctuary Movement is an initiative to help vegans rescue and care for farmed animals. It centers on a radical revisioning of sanctuary on a grassroots level, with the goal being to inspire and empower more people to use whatever resources they have available right now to provide safe, nurturing homes to non-humans who are typically seen only as commodities. Rocky is here today to tell us more about this revolution and how humans see and interact with farmed animals and other animals too. Hi, Rocky. Welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show today to speak with us about the Micro Sanctuary Movement. This is an initiative that was started in 2014 with the objective that you don't need to own a large farm property in order to rescue and provide sanctuary for animals. In fact, you can work with whatever resources you have to provide nurturing homes for rescued animals. Can you tell us more about this philosophy, please, and why the Micro Sanctuary Movement was created?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that a lot of people have kind of a dream, especially in the animal rights movement, of one day having their own sanctuary and, you know, having that sort of direct relationship with rescued animals, being able to provide a safe forever home for them. But the model as it has existed requires, you know, having a giant property, tons of funds, and things that really kind of feel more like a dream to people than just accessible, something they can do now, something that they can really start to, you know, manifest now. But at the same time, we see that, you know, a lot of people will be able to provide a home to two cats or three dogs. And those same people could be using those same resources to also provide a home to two chickens or two pigs or, you know, one fish. And so the idea is really, no matter where you are, there's an ability for you to provide a safe home for an animal in need and not only save their life, but also have many of the benefits that you see with larger sanctuaries in terms of those rescued animals now being ambassadors and speaking to a larger structure of exploitation that we're trying to end.
That sounds great. Our co-host Elise here has a question for you.
Right. Hi, Rocky. Elise here. So I understand the Micro Sanctuary Movement follows a list of core principles, the first one being ethical veganism. Can you start there and tell us about more of the core principles behind the movement?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that what we see is a lot of work being done in the movement kind of evolved over time and might kind of shift its focus and stray away from the initial principles that ground it. So for us with the micro-sanctuary movement, it was really important that we outlined a list of core principles from the get-go, so that we have really a solid understanding of what we're trying to achieve and what we're, you know, trying to promote. So our first core principle is ethical veganism. So that's the foundation of it all. And I imagine many of your listeners are already kind of familiar with that concept. Our second core principle that fits right into that is no consumption of animal products. And that includes products coming from the micro-sanctuary residents themselves. So that means that if you have a rescued chicken who's laying eggs, a rescued sheep who is needing to be sheared, and now there's wool, still not saying that it's okay to at any time use things that are coming from the rescued residents themselves, and saying that, you know, ethical veganism is still the most ethical thing, no matter what situation the animals are in. And part of that also is our third core principle, which is a rejection of quote-unquote humane animal husbandry. So really kind of rejecting this humane myth, and the idea that you can ever have quote-unquote humane animal products. Then our fourth core principle is a little bit different. So it is, we say that there needs to be absolutely no breeding of resident animals and every proper precaution taken to avoid breeding. So for mammals, that looks like spaying and neutering. For birds, that looks like, you know, being able to monitor their egg laying if they're laying eggs, and not have any accidental hatching. And the idea with that is really the same thing you'd see hopefully with any dog or cat shelter, where there's so many animals who need rescuing. We do not want more being created and taking that space. And also we see that with many of these animals, they've been very intensively bred, and not, you know, continuing to propagate the harms of domestication itself. Then the fifth core principle is priority given to the safety and physical and emotional well-being of the residents. So always putting their needs and their interests first. Never putting them in situations that in any way jeopardizes them or is in any way exploiting them for human interest. And then kind of along the same lines with that is our sixth core principle, which is that all human and non-human interactions should be respectful. Then our seventh core principle is that animals should not be purchased. And this is something that can be a little bit more controversial, but the idea with this is that there are always animals who are in need of homes, and who can be rescued without a single cent going toward the industries that we're trying to combat. So even though it can definitely be very tempting, we really deter people from paying for animals and buying into that system. And then the eighth core principle is that micro-sanctuary should really be spaces of collective liberation. So individuals of all species, including humans, should be safe from violence, oppression, and exploitation.
And if people are more interested in wanting to learn about these principles, they can be found on the website at microsanctuarymovement.org. And thank you for those explanations, Rocky. So you yourself, you're living the micro-sanctuary life in Brooklyn, New York. It's a very urban area. I've been there before. Can you tell us about the residents of your micro-sanctuary? And I understand that you started out by having two rescued chickens living in your college dorm room.
Yeah, so you can very much have a micro-sanctuary anywhere, and that's one of the beautiful things about the model. You know, your micro-sanctuary can literally just be one rescued individual, and that still qualifies as a micro-sanctuary because you are providing sanctuary to them. So you can see how it becomes, you know, much more accessible than the idea of having, you know, 100 acres to be a sanctuary. So for me, I live in a house in Brooklyn with several other animal rights activists. And in our home, we have three rescued dogs, four rescued chickens, three rescued quails, and one rescued fish, Samantha, and then kind of a revolving door of fosters who come in before going to other sanctuaries. With these guys, they pretty much all cohabitate, aside from Samantha, who's in water, and they have access to our little backyard here, but do all predominantly live inside.
Our co-host Elise has another question.
Hi, so Rocky, your specialty is chickens. They're the most abused land animals on Earth, and I see there's a great opportunity for rescuing chickens and having them as a part of your home life or micro sanctuary. Can you tell our listeners about some situations that you've rescued chickens from and how they can thrive in a micro sanctuary setting?
Yeah, definitely. So I think for anyone who's listening who's never had a chance to really get to know a chicken in a situation where, you know, she could actually be herself, I really encourage you to explore that, because I know for me, I grew up really kind of disliking chickens. I only really had negative interactions with them. I only was around them in situations where they had every reason to not want to interact with me, to fear me. And so it wasn't really until I got to know them in a situation where they were safe and they were cared for and they were finally treated as someone that I actually got to realize how amazing they really are. And I think a lot of people who spend time with chickens end up realizing that they're pretty similar to cats in a lot of ways. They have very cat-like personalities. They do things very much on their terms. A lot of them will kind of just stare at you and watch you, and then you'll have the occasional chicken who just really, really, really wants to cuddle with you. And so I have four chickens here, and they're all wildly different personalities. And they've all been rescued from different places around Brooklyn. So that's a pretty special thing about micro sanctuaries, too, in that many of the rescues are very, very local to where the micro sanctuary itself is located, which is also great for outreach purposes. And so my guys were rescued from a religious ritual sacrifice known as Kaporo that happens here in Brooklyn, and they were also rescued from situations where they were either dumped or escaped, likely a transport truck headed to slaughter. I think when people get to know them in a home setting, it can be a pretty jarring experience, just in that, you know, we're so used to seeing them outside in a very farm-like situation, and to see a chicken just totally comfortable curling up on your bed, or a chicken perched on a window staring out, watching the birds just like a cat would. It really, I think, starts to shift how people see these individuals, and we can start to see them more as companions or individuals who can be companions to us, and individuals who then, because of that, maybe we should start reconsidering how we're treating them and how we've been doing them in general.
Exactly. That brings me to my next question. I know you highly believe in the power of sanctuaries to save lives, fight speciesism, and to make activists better advocates for animals. Can you speak more on this, please?
Yeah. So with that, you know, one of the just most basic things is the more sanctuaries we have of any size, the more lives are saved. So I think, you know, micro sanctuaries and large sanctuaries, and I should say I actually work part-time at a large sanctuary, Catskill Animal Sanctuary.
I know, you gave me a tour there, Rocky, a couple of years ago. That's how I met you.
I kind of straddle those two worlds, and I think sometimes people can see them as in conflict, like micro sanctuaries are drawing funds that go to large sanctuaries or things of that sort. But I really see them as having kind of a simpatico. And so if there's, you know, a special needs animal who a larger sanctuary might not be able to take in, well, maybe there's a micro sanctuary where now they can live in more of a home-like environment and get maybe more individualized care than a sanctuary caring for, you know, 300 animals might be able to do. So that's one of the kind of most basic things with micro sanctuaries, and how I see them fitting in that regard. Then they also just really, truly do fight speciesism. And that's what I was talking about a second ago with chickens being in this home-like situation. And we see that with a range of species, just, you know, seeing them in an environment that we've been taught they kind of don't belong in. And we've been taught that because it makes us see them as individuals, and the industry's desire is for us to only see them in kind of this population level way. Just, you know, that barn with 3,000 chickens, never see them as individuals. And I think from an activist perspective, once you get to know them as individuals, it changes everything. You're no longer advocating for the abstract, you're advocating for your family. So when I'm talking to someone about chickens and what they experience and why we should care, I'm not just talking about chickens in a generic sense. I'm talking about Rose. I'm talking about Phoenix. I'm talking about Coretta. You know, so it becomes this much more intimate thing, and I think that's also much more compelling to the public, because the public can relate to individuals. They can relate to the story of this one individual who you know, who you love, and they can feel that emotion. And I think that also kind of keeps activists from burning out, too, because you're speaking about those you have this intense emotional connection to, and so you're no longer just fighting this industry. You're fighting for those specific individuals you love.
That's such a powerful message. For people who are inspired by this interview and would like to start their own micro sanctuary, what advice can you offer to get them started?
I definitely encourage anyone who's thinking about it to really educate yourself and go for it. With a lot of these species, the information that's out there on how to properly care for them is unfortunately coming from the individuals and the institutions that are exploiting them. So with chickens, maybe the majority of the resources you'd find would be coming from, you know, online backyard chicken forums where people are talking about how to better exploit them for their eggs. And so I encourage you to look into, you know, basically animal-centric resources. And so for really the kind of whole range of species who you might be considering rescuing and caring for in a micro-sanctuary, there's a series of groups that are on Facebook and begin with Vegans With. So there's Vegans With Chickens, Vegans With Rodents, Vegans With Rabbits, Vegans With Fishes, and these are fantastic resources where you can find people who are already providing that home to these species and can give you kind of a more individual-centric perspective of what you should consider when preparing for them and then throughout their lifelong care. And then also the micro sanctuary movement, we are here as a resource. So definitely check out our website. You can also get in touch with me directly at my email address, which is rocky@microsanctuarymovement.org. And through that, you'll also see that the micro sanctuary movement actually not only has some species-specific care guides, but also a grant program. So we will actually be able to give you, even if you're, you know, an individual, not a 501c3 nonprofit, we are able to give you funds to get you started and to support you in long-term care.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Rocky, for coming on the show today to speak to us about the micro sanctuary movement and how you may be inspired to start your own micro sanctuary. For more information on the micro sanctuary movement, visit microsanctuarymovement.org. As Rocky mentioned, visit all those Vegans With groups on Facebook. And yeah, I'm on the Vegans With Chickens group because that interests me. So thank you so much, Rocky. It was so nice to be in touch with you again. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We have some events to share coming up this weekend. Saturday, August 18th from 1 to 3 p.m. at McLeod Athletic Park in Langley. It's Langley Pig Save's monthly pig vigil, this time at Ribfest, the Langley Ribfest. They say, please join us in spreading the message of kindness and compassion. See the Langley Pig Save Facebook page for more details. Again, that's tomorrow, the 18th, 1 to 3 p.m. in Langley. Then on Sunday, August 19th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Veg Meetup Vancouver is doing a vegan Sri Lankan dinner. For only $11, you can enjoy a delicious vegan Sri Lankan feast and get to know other members of the community. The location will be revealed to those who sign up, so visit meetup.com and search for Veg Meetup Vancouver to attend their Sri Lankan dinner.
It's at a food court. It's just
a secret.
Yeah, I've been to it many times.
Oh, okay.
Several times. It's really good. You can go see a movie after.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. All right. And then on Monday, August 20th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at Black Law Broadway location, Vancouver Vegan Drinks is having their monthly meetup. So they do a monthly sort of casual vegan drinks meetup every month at the Broadway location of the Black Lodge. It's an all-vegetarian bar. So again, that's Monday, August 20th, 6:30 to 9 p.m., Black Lodge Broadway. Then on Thursday, August 23rd at 6:30 p.m., at the Oak Ridge SDA Hall at 5350 Bailey Street in Vancouver, there will be a presentation by Dr. Will Tuttle called Healing Our World, A Deeper Look at Food. Entry is by donation. Dr. Tuttle is the author of the best-selling book called The World Peace Diet, and he'll be delivering an inspiring talk about the hidden dimensions of our culture's food system. I understand he will also be presenting a piano performance.
He will be.
Yeah, he's a pianist and a composer, so that's
Yeah, we play his music on the show sometimes. He's right. So brilliantly talented with his music. So you get a piano performance as well. And there's a snack luck as well.
Right.
So you bring snacks like potluck. So I'm going. If anyone wants to go with me, you're welcome to. I'm bringing my non-vegan friend.
Awesome. Yeah. Sounds good. And Allison, I think you had an event to share as well.
Yes, as I had mentioned last week, so the event that you just announced, it's with Vancouver Meatless Meetup. That's on Will Tuttle, August the 23rd. And I am also a co-organizer with Vancouver Meatless Meetup. We're just a nonprofit group that puts on vegan food events around town to spread the word and to eat delicious food. And I'll be hosting a dinner meetup at the new Virtuous Pie Restaurant at UBC. That's at the university on the west side on Tuesday, August the 28th at 7 p.m. So there are a limited number of spaces. I would recommend to RSVP soon. And I'm excited about hosting this. It's our first one there. So there's going to be, each person gets a salad, a Caesar salad course. Have you had their Caesar salad?
Yes. Yeah.
Really
so
good, right?
Yeah.
And, this is all vegan, right? This is like a 100% vegan restaurant. And then we, every person gets a piece of a variety of six of their different pizzas.
Wow.
So you get to try six pizzas.
Nice.
And then not only only that, you get a scoop of one of their brand new delicious coconut almond creamy ice creams.
Cool.
The new flavors are bourbon vanilla, rocky road, and hazelnut latte.
Nice.
Those have not been debuted yet. You'll get to try them here for the first time. So to RSVP, go to meetup.com/meatlessmeetup. And as I said, spots are going fast. So do that sooner than later. Yeah.
That sounds great. Yeah, I love Rich's Pie. The food's so good. So as always, if you have an animal-related event that you would like us to share on the show, shoot us an email, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Every Saturday from 11 to 3 p.m., visit the downtown Eastside Women's Market. Join us at our third annual summer market with all women vendors, hosted outdoors in close proximity to the downtown Eastside Women's Center. The downtown Eastside Women's Market is a conflict-free and safe space to celebrate women exploring innovation and creativity, providing skills development, income generation, and neighborhood engagement. Find secondhand treasures, recycled goods, arts and crafts, and jewelry. Enjoy the music, food, and performances. Most of all, come to connect with our community of women. Every Saturday from 11 to 3 p.m. until September 1st, the Downtown Eastside Women's Market.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. For our feature interview today, we have Ryan Phillips on the show. He is a full-time animal activist who hails from Williamsburg, Virginia, and lives with three pigs, one chicken, and a rabbit in a condo. He and his animal family are constantly outdoing activism and raising awareness for animals. He calls his work Life with Pigs, which is dedicated to educating people about the injustices faced by animals and how we can better coexist with these fellow earthlings. It operates under the guiding principle that animals are our equals and deserve equal consideration for their needs and desires. Ryan is here today to tell us more about Life with Pigs and a chicken and a rabbit. Hi, Ryan, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. How are you and Pumpkin doing?
We're doing pretty well. Yeah, I actually got this chair specifically so I could have the pig sit on my lap. It's a little wider than the normal chair, so.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today to tell us about your animal activism. I've been following you on Facebook for over a year now, and we had the pleasure of meeting at last year's Animal Rights Conference in Washington, D.C., to which you brought Charlotte the pig. Right now you've got Pumpkin on your lap. But before we get to that, I'm really interested to know about your vegan story. Can you please tell us about the journey in your life that led to your veganism?
So what happened for us was my dad died at the age of 63. And so when he died, at first, I think my reaction was just to assume I was going to die young from some heart-related thing. And so we actually watched Food Inc. not too much longer after that. And that was, I think, the turning point. It really boiled down to seeing that animals were dying, even though I know I knew that, and I know that it's not something that, you know, people are unaware of. But seeing it and then having to sort of come to terms with that, I just couldn't do it anymore. And so once I saw it, once I knew it, it was over for me. And so my family, my kids were younger at the time, but I told them I was planning to go vegan, and my wife said that her and my daughter would go vegetarian, and then about an hour later she's like, forget it, let's just all go vegan together. And so that was pretty much the transition. It was pretty quick.
How long ago was that?
That was 6.5 years ago.
Wow, I'm stunned. That's been a short journey for you, and you've done so much. So our first interview today was about the micro sanctuary movement and understanding that you don't need to own a farm property to create an animal sanctuary. Now, you yourself, you live in a condo, and you have done just that. You live with three pigs named Charlotte, Millie, and Pumpkin, plus a new family member named Beatrice the chicken, and then there's also Tesla the rabbit, and then there's the humans who you mentioned. So can you start by sharing with us the stories of these animals and how did they come into your life in your home?
Yeah, and can we pause real quick? And I'm going to let Pumpkin out the room real quick. Sorry. All right, sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah, so, Beatrice walks out.
Hi, Beatrice. Beatrice isn't wearing her diaper.
She isn't, yeah.
You might have some accidents.
that'll be okay.
So please do share with us the stories of these animals and how did they come into your life and home?
Okay, so it initially started, I had been doing activism here in Williamsburg. I was going to a corner by CVS, like a drugstore here, and I had been there maybe, I'm going to say like 100 days or something like that at the time, where I just did it every day. And so a family that lived in town stopped to say hello. They wanted to tell me that they had a pig and that, you know, they wanted to get involved. And so that was sort of the starting point, because not too long after that, they told me about Pumpkin, which was one of the pigs at the place where their pig had come from, and how she needed a home because, you know, they were done breeding her and they were moving. And so it's not usually a good ending for 5-year-old pigs. And so hearing that, you know, I thought, okay, we're on the second floor in a condo, and I know that most pigs get bigger than, you know, people expect. And so I thought it was crazy. And so I wrote a friend who does a lot of work with mini pigs and asked her, you know, and she said, oh, you'll be perfect as long as you can get her up and down the stairs or teach her how to walk up and down the stairs. And so we agreed to adopt Pumpkin. And then in the process, we read up on pigs and found out how, you know, a lot of times in the wild, the families will stay together, especially the females. So that's when we asked to bring Charlotte with her mom. They did give us Charlotte along with Pumpkin, and that was the start of it. And so that's how we got those two. Millie, the same friends who had told us about Pumpkin, they tried to adopt Millie from a farm in town that had 50 pigs, and the person said, their mom owned the land and said, get all the pigs gone. And so one of them was Millie. They tried to adopt Millie. Their pig hated her, flipped the table in the kitchen, destroyed, you know, like the kitchen, trying to get at her. And so we're like, well, we'll help out. We'll watch her to give your pig a break. And yeah, Millie's here a year later. So that was Millie. Tesla the rabbit, I would always see a rabbit out in Colonial Williamsburg when we were with the pigs. And so I thought, you know, that'd be like a cool mix to get like a larger rabbit to just hang out with the pigs from a rescue. And then we went to a rescue party and you could just like interact with the rabbits and, you know, get down in their cages with them. And so Tesla let me pick her up and hold her for like 2 hours. And so even though she wasn't the larger rabbit that I was thinking that, you know, be good with the pigs, like she does really well with getting along with them. And then Beatrice's story is she escaped from an egg farm. And that's our story because that's the one that the FBI needs to hear. So
right, I've heard that.
But yeah, I mean, and I honestly don't know the full story, and it's always best to keep it that way. So, you know, for all I know, she just walked off the farm one day.
Right. So I understand, like, she's been genetically modified to lay probably about 300 eggs a year, and that's what really breaks down a chicken's body and drastically shortens their lives. Otherwise, they can live for quite some time. So can you tell us about the implant that you've had placed for Beatrice?
Yeah, and it hasn't happened yet because you have to wait for the first egg, and so we're not really sure how old she is because of, you know, her story. But yeah, it is amazing how many people I meet who have backyard, you know, chickens, and, you know, think they're doing this great thing and giving these chickens this great life, and to some degree, you know, like are, but at the same time don't realize, you know, the cost on the body of the chicken. And so the implant, what it is essentially, it goes in their back and it releases a hormone that will stop them from producing an egg. There is a way to spay chickens, but it's very dangerous. And then even then, they still have the eggs inside them, just not fully developing. And so there's still issues there. So this is the safest way, but there's not many people who do it. So again, the price is, you know, it's up there in terms of like, it's way cheaper to have three pigs than it is to have one chicken, which I think a lot of people don't get when they, you know, think sanctuaries, you know, you call them up and say, I found a chicken, and they're not factoring in the cost of things like that, where if the sanctuary, you know, and I know they all want to do the very best that they can, but cost-wise, you know, it could cost us potentially $700 per year just to get her implanted. But the alternative is, you know, at 2 years of age, she may already have acquired of like ovarian cancer, or if not, like something that's going to kill her or make her life very painful. And
Yeah, that's a reality for a chicken that's been bred for the egg laying industry. And I just want our listeners to know that chickens in nature are only meant to create about 15 to 20 eggs a year. So popping out one egg per day is not natural. It's very hard on the body.
Yeah, I always equate it. I always say to people, you know, you think of like a female human cycle being like there's about 12 times a year. And so while that might not have been like the same, I guess, spread out period, but they would have, you know, essentially that 12 eggs, and it has that same toll on the body, even though it's not the same exact process, you know, chicken versus human, but it is a pretty similar toll that it takes in terms of taking all those resources away from her body, you know, to produce that egg. And so to go from 12 to 350, which is what the ISA Brown, I guess, is the type of chicken that Beatrice is, essentially they lay 350 eggs. And even when you look in the backyard, you know, farmer guidebook, whether you're talking about how great what they do is compared to, you know, regular farms or whatever, or factory farms, they say in there, you know, don't expect them to live past 2 years. You know, like they're going to wear themselves out because of this. So it's like they even acknowledge the toll it's taking. But for some reason, it doesn't go that step further of like, okay, maybe we shouldn't be doing this.
Well, most people are familiar with what it's like to live with a dog or a cat, but pigs or a chicken is a whole different story. So, Ryan, what is it like to live with three pigs, one chicken, and a rabbit, and then there's the humans, too?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. Like, we love it. Every day you wake up excited to see them. You know, there's typically I wake up on either the couch or on a mattress that's pushed into the couch with the pigs laying next to me. And never next to the pig that I went to sleep next to. There's always someone that squeezed in or climbed on top. And then my wife will sleep with a Yorkie on the couch, and then a rabbit will come jumping through whenever. And then Beatrice is the only one that has a bedtime and like an actual bed area just to give her darkness so that maybe we're not correct in this, but I think she's a little more light sensitive in terms of the cycle of laying and stuff like that. Because I know that sometimes they'll mess with lighting to try to make them lay more, you know, whether it be just constant lighting or shutting it off all the time. Yeah, and she's been amazingly easy to live with. You know, I thought it was going to be crazy, but, you know, with the diapers and then, you know, like her having the pigs to be kind of her flock, I think it's worked out really well because I know they're very much a flock animal and stick together with their, you know, their group. But she just hangs out with the pigs and, you know, beds down with them, and they love having her around to, like, dig her claws into them or to peck at them with her beak. And then the pigs, they definitely have moments when, like, you know, like siblings, they'll beat up on each other or be in a bad mood. But for the most part, they're, you know, just wanting to hang out with you on the couch and, you know, have you love on them. Like when I meet people like out when we're doing our activism, you know, they'll always say, oh, do they just always want to eat? And when we're out, they're always eating grass or treats or whatever. But you get home and they just want to get in your lap and, you know, sleep with you. And yeah, like they're, it's like all six of the animals that live in our house are just, you know, the dog's probably the hardest one to live with. Like,
they seem all very cuddly.
They are. Yeah. I mean, like Beatrice will fall asleep on you. The rabbit, you know, she's a 2 a.m. friend, but she'll like come out then and want to like be loved on. And the pigs are always about following you around and laying down on your lap or so. Yeah. I mean, it's, like, there's never, like, a moment when you can't find someone to go hang out with and make life seem a little better.
Wow. Well, I know that many of your days are spent taking out one or two of your companion animals out into these busy trafficked areas in your town, and you take them to graze on grass while many people come out to meet them. Can you tell us more about how this works? This is part of your activism.
Yeah, I mean, and that's... like, I remember when I first took Charlotte out and we ran into a bunch of college kids, and like, it was the first time I'd sort of had, you know, like the, here's a pig and here's people meeting them. And, you know, there's so many saying like, oh, I don't want to eat meat anymore, or I want to go vegan. And so my first thought was, you know, how do you do this and make sure that you're not, you know, you're not circusing them. You're not turning them into like an act or, you know, basically going against everything you're fighting to try to change. And so that's why, you know, it's pretty key that there always be something that they can just be doing that's what they would want to do, and then at the same time people can come meet them. And, you know, and if they didn't seem like they enjoyed it, you know, we definitely reconsider. But for the most part, we go, if there's clover or grass, you know, we set up there, and so Charlotte or Pumpkin or Millie will start eating it, and then Beatrice just likes to hang out with them, and she'll eat the grass with them, or eat it out of their mouth usually, which they seem to be okay with. But yeah, like they get to do what they want to do, and then we'll just have, you know, hundreds of people sometimes within, you know, a short period who are just walking through, you know, usually Colonial Williamsburg, and will stop and, you know, want to meet them. I think at first they think it's part of Colonial Williamsburg, and then they're pretty quick to, like, read, like, the buttons on, like, the pigs will say, like, it's not okay to eat animals, or, you know, something like lately we've been doing, you know, chickens are as smart as dogs, just to try to get some message into their head. And it's amazing how easy it makes it, because then they tell each other what the button says, or they'll say, oh, I agree, you know, like, we shouldn't be eating you. And you know that they're not vegetarian or vegan, but it's just they're meeting the victim and they're seeing the message, and then putting that together, you know, makes them realize that, okay, yeah, this is how I really feel, whether I, you know, like I always say, like, everyone's a vegan, they just don't act on it. And so it's just trying to get them to realize that they should act on that for these animals.
Right. You know, I suspect that for most people, this is the very first time, perhaps, that they're having an interaction with an animal who they usually eat as food. And I think many people must be walking away transformed. Can you tell us about this and how you see this connection happening when they realize that these animals are the same animals that we eat? And I'm wondering if you see a difference with adults versus children as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the coolest thing about being out with the animals is it is such a universal thing. Like, there's very few people who just, you know, hate animals or aren't interested in, you know, knowing them or knowing more about them. And so, you know, I think within the vegan activism world, I'm willing to bet that most people would agree the hardest audience we have is, like, older men, like white men over the age of 50, like, seems to be just like a really hard group, you know, for, I'm sure, a whole host of reasons we could, you know, figure out. But even with those groups, you know, within that group, you know, I'll have, like, the old man come over and, you know, have, like, the bacon joke at first. And I think a decent job of figuring out who's just trying to be a jerk and who's trying to, you know, just, like, voice the thing in their head that they need to get out to move forward. And so you'll get, you know, people like that. And then an hour later, that same person standing there introducing Charlotte to, you know, everyone that comes by, or Pumpkin, and saying, you know, you got to meet my friend and you got to see what they can do. And pigs are so smart. And so you've seen from, like, the I need to make a bacon joke to the this is my new best friend that I can't wait to, you know, tell people how amazing they are, because it, you know, it's changed how I see them. Or even you'll meet pig farmers, because, you know, I live in Virginia, which is, you know, not as bad as probably North Carolina, but, you know, pretty bad. And so almost everyone, I think, knows a pig farmer, or was, it seems, when I'm out there. And so when they meet them and then see how, you know, clean they are and hear about them living in a condo, you know, I think they kind of knew that the way they kept them had a lot to do with, you know, how clean they might be, or, you know, how friendly they might be. But when they see them, a lot of times you'll have them say, you know, like, this totally changes my perception of, you know, how I viewed them, or stuff like that. So even in those hard, you know, the hardest of target areas, you feel like you're making an impact. And so then certainly with, like, kids, you definitely feel like they're picking up on, you know, the subtle message. And then we try to, like, I have for Beatrice, like, PETA has their Chicken's Life, like, little comic books. And so we try to hand those out. You know, is there anything, I guess, like, gentle that we can give out to kids to, like, get them to read about it?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, have people actually come from these interactions and said to you, I want to go vegan now, or I'm going to stop eating animals because of this?
No, yeah, I mean, I'd say, you know, it might not be daily that I have, like, that direct, like, I'm going to do this, but I'd say within a week of being out there 7 days, we probably have, you know, a dozen interactions where they say something, like, explicitly, like, you know, as a result of this, I'm, you know, going to change, or I'm going to not, you know, eat, whether it be pigs or meat or go vegan. You know, there's a lot of that. Like, you definitely get a lot of direct feedback that sounds like, you know, they've definitely changed. And I know, you know, it's hard because people can watch Earthlings and then turn around and, you know, go to Outback. And so people have a pretty good psychological defense mechanism against accepting what they know is true. And that's one of the things I've been trying to address with making the new leaflet that has the pictures of all our animals on the front, and then on the inside, sort of the story of what's happening to those animals, you know, everywhere else, to try to give them like the actual animal they remember, you know, the part of their vacation that they think of is like, you know, a lot of people say it's the best part of their vacation. And so to try to give them animals they can connect to, I think, you know, so if they go to the Life with Pigs page and follow Charlotte or follow Beatrice, it hopefully will keep them connected to that feeling they had in that moment, because I definitely pick up on a lot of people wanting to change right then. So I guess it's trying to keep them, you know, some way in contact so it stays.
Yeah, well, with all the interactions that you've had with hundreds of people, with your companion animals, and seeing from all kinds of perspectives how different people react, you know, most of them are, of course, meat eaters. Do you have a general observation that you can share about what it is that the human psyche goes through from when we are born as children? I believe we're born vegan, and then maturing into adulthood when it comes to most people's relationships with food and animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think 4-H is a good example of the extreme version of it, but I think to some degree, you know, every kid gets a bit of the 4-H treatment, where almost like we trick them into eating animals before we really let them know, you know, who they're eating, and then by the time they fully get it, you know, it's too late, they're addicted to it, or they have, you know, that guilt of, you know, like, I think the reason that older people have a harder time switching is because they've got more built up years of guilt, you know, like, oh, look what I've done. If I change now, I have to accept that all these years I've done this. And so the same with kids, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that college students are usually our target audience, because they can make their own choices and they don't have, you know, really that much time of paying for their own food, which I think is, you know, probably the hardest thing, thinking, you know, I went and I gave someone money to do this to an animal, and they don't really have too much of that. And so I think that that's what happens, I think, is we make kids sort of a part of the system before they realize what the system is. And then it's, you know, it's hard for them to sort of back out of that.
Well, you say you try to work as much as you can, sleep as little as you can, and achieve the most impact for animals as possible. And I know you say you are a nonstop activist, and I certainly see that for sure on Facebook as I follow you. Can you tell us about how you weave activism into your daily life, such as when you're going to the grocery store? And sometimes I'm reading posts from you saying, well, it's really easy to know where I can go because I only go to places where Beatrice is allowed.
Yeah, I mean, it helps when I can bring any of the animals in. And I mean, so much of that is from me. I mean, going into a store where you see in someone's cart, like, especially like if I see a package of bacon, it takes a whole lot of, I guess, like stamina or, you know, like effort to not like go up to them and say, you know, do you realize, you know, and explain how bacon gets to be. So it definitely helps if I can focus on the animal and at least feel like they're there being their own voice. People are seeing them. But there's not many grocery stores that will look the other way every time I bring them in. You know, but in grocery stores, I will, if like I'm in the checkout line, I always, and my hat doesn't have it on right now, but on the back of my hat is always a button that says it's not okay to eat animals. And so if you're behind me, you know, about to buy some bodies, at least to some degree, you have to face the reality that someone out there knows, you know, it's not okay. And so, and then if, you know, someone puts meat down next to my, you know, food on like a conveyor belt or something, like I always try to address, you know, like, oh, did you know this is how that happens? Or, you know, this is what happens to those animals. Most of the time can do it without, you know, having it get bad. But, you know, there's always people who just, they don't want to know and it really makes them mad. And so, you know, I did get banned from Trader Joe's for life for a reason. So,
oh, no.
I'm unbanned at this point, and I'm told Charlotte's allowed in there anytime. But yeah, it's a long story. But yeah, so my thing used to be if I saw that someone was buying any animal product, I would address it. I'd say, you know, if they're buying milk, here's what happens to dairy cows or whatever. And so it was almost like I had to do it. And I still do a lot of that, but I think part of me thinks that, you know, I'm sure there's people it affects, and I had people put stuff back and say, I'd never thought about that, and I'm glad you pointed out. But a lot of people, it's probably the wrong moment for them to be confronted. And so that's not to say it's not probably effective to confront them, but, you know, like, there's only so many stores I can get banned from, I guess, before, you know, it seems like I can be more effective with the animals, you know, out in public and stuff. And so for the large part, I try to avoid grocery stores because not a fun place to be if you like animals.
Wow. I really admire your drive. And, you know, most people don't have as much drive as you do when it comes to advocating for social justice issues or just really anything that they care about. What drives you to keep fighting for the animals? And can you talk a bit about your self-care, too? Because it just sounds like this could just drive you mad when, you know, you're seeing the dead animals that you live with in the grocery stores and people are calling your pigs bacon.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I joke somewhat, but it may be the truth that, like, you get to a point where burnout is just your normal and you start to just get used to feeling that level of, you know, bad, I guess. And that's, you know, probably not the happiest way to put it. But I think trying to, one, pay attention to the changes you are making and the changes you are seeing. So when you do have a good interaction, trying to give that more power than, you know, the bad interaction. Which, you know, is always hard because it's so easy to focus on the negative or to let something, you know, stupid like someone calling them bacon destroy your day. So I think over time, doing it every day, you do start to at least get better with blocking some things out or letting it go and trying to focus on the good. But yeah, I think my self-care is to just never stop. If I stop, then I think about what's happening out there. And that's when, you know, things tend to, like, you know, become depressing and, you know, like, you get sort of dark, sad thoughts about things. And so, like, if I'm always moving, then there's no time for that. And so I guess that's kind of what I do, which I don't think works for most people. But I like a lot of my heroes, like, I studied history at William and Mary, and a lot of my heroes were like the almost like people that, like, fought so hard for change in the past, and we still don't really treat them as, like, heroes because they were so crazy about it and never backed down, like Charles Sumner or Thaddeus Stevens, like the people who fought against slavery and were called, like, you know, the radical Republicans or the extremists because of how hard they fought. But in the time that they were fighting, they were seen as, you know, crazy because why do they care so much and why are they putting so much effort into this? And so I think part of me admiring them so much is maybe because that's just my personality, the desire to, like, never stop and feel like I can, you know, whatever I did yesterday, I should be able to do more the next day. So, yeah, I'm definitely not the go-to person for self-care advice, that's for sure.
But, you know, I want to say that a lot of activists say that their self-care is they'll go to an animal sanctuary, but hey, you have one at home.
Yeah, that definitely, I mean, it's a double-edged sword at times because, you know, when you go to Save Vigil and you see the pigs on the truck and then you're laying next to your pigs who, you know, a lot of times you can identify characteristics of pigs on the truck where you're like, oh, that reminds me of Charlotte, the way that one acted that way, or, you know, like, that's Millie's look. And so in that sense, sometimes it can be bad, but for the most part, yeah, I mean, being able to at any minute of the day go and lay on the couch with the pig and have them, like, snuggle up and bury their, you know, head under your chin, or
that's physically actually de-stressing to make that contact.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I definitely, and I a lot of times, you know, like, anytime I meet a vegan, you know, out here, or if they're coming into town, like, they're always invited to come hang out with our pigs because, you know, like, they love having people come hang out on the couch with them, give them treats and pet them and, you know, hang out. So they think it's great. But I know that for vegans, you know, who most of our life is seeing the awful in the world, it's really nice to see, you know, these three pigs that are like a family just getting to have, you know, hopefully the best life that they can have. And so, and, you know, now having the chicken here to kind of add to that where people can see, you know, just how good life can be, you know, when you try. So,
right. Well, you talked a little bit about the leaflet that you've created to give out to people who you think have been positively affected by their interactions with you and the animals. On the leaflet, you speak about speciesism and that taking freedom away from animals makes us into bullies. Can you tell us more about this message that it is that you want to impress on the people who you meet on the streets?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times when I think about like what we're fighting for and why it's so important, it's easy to put it, or easier to put it in terms that I think most people understand. And I know there's like a certain amount of controversy because sometimes people, I think, misplay that hand where they'll take it in a direction it shouldn't be taken, and it can become offensive to certain groups to like have certain things compared that maybe shouldn't be in the way they are. But I think people relate to the idea of, like, say, bullying, or they relate to the idea that, you know, slavery is wrong or that rape is wrong. And so if you can show, you know, that connection there, it helps people not feel as comfortable about that thing. And so, you know, with bullying, you know, there's definitely that push of, you know, we shouldn't treat people, you know, the way that, you know, we see a lot in schools, or, you know, like obviously now with a lot of the Me Too movement, where there is this, you know, sense of like people using power over others. And so if we can help people see that taking an animal, taking all their freedom away from them, you know, forcing them to do whatever it is we want them to do for their short lives, and then killing them, you know, to not see that as bullying, I mean, it would take an insane amount of effort to try to come up with an explanation where it isn't bullying, because how do you deny a living being all, like, everything they want, and not feel like in some way you're using the old might makes right justification for your actions, which no one feels comfortable with, you know, in any other scenario. So why is it okay, you know, if you're doing it to Beatrice or to, you know, Charlotte?
Yeah. And Beatrice, she just, you know, just looking at her right now, she's, I think all animals are beautiful. She's a beautiful animal, but I think it's just wonderful to be able to see her and appreciate her. I imagine it's the same for the people on the streets. A lot of people identify chickens as sort of like, you know, chicken, that's something I eat, or chickens in the masses at the grocery store, they're dead bodies. But this is a real, living, breathing, beautiful animal. She's enjoying your affection right now. And I just want people to appreciate that, as I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the nicest things when you're out, when you hear people say, you know, I didn't realize whatever it is, you know, I didn't realize chickens could be, you know, so like social, like with humans, interacting, staring at you, like really trying to figure out what you're doing, and, you know, the way she'll, like, she enjoys being pet. And I think it's hard because I think most people interact with animals who are in situations where it's not about them, it's not about them being happy. And so their view of humans isn't going to be as rosy, you know, whereas when they meet Charlotte, Pumpkin, or Millie, or, you know, Beatrice, it's animals who their whole day, you know, everyone around them is trying to, like, you know, love on them, or, you know, make sure they have what they need, or, you know, taking them to do, you know, things that they enjoy. And so when they meet them, their view of people is that people are good. And so it gives them a different side, you know, a different view. You know, because, like, I always meet the people that work at Smithfield who say, oh, pigs would do the same things to us. You know, they're so mean. And, like, you just don't know how they don't get. Yeah, if you threw me in, like, a elevator for 6 months, yeah, I'd be really mad if when you let me out. I wouldn't be raring to hug you or anything. So, yeah, and I think that really helps, that people get to meet. Like, I hate to compare, like, the pigs or the chicken to a dog, but that's what people relate to. And so when they can see that, you know, Beatrice, you know, in so many ways is like having a cat or a dog that wants to be pet, that wants to, you know, snuggle up on the couch and stuff, and, you know, interacts with you, pays attention to what you're doing, and, you know, really seems to be taking it all in. I think when they see that, you know, especially up close while they're, you know, petting her or something, it definitely feels like it's impacting them in the right way.
Well, you have a Patreon page for people to support the work you do, because you do work full-time as an activist, but it doesn't come with a full-time salary. Would you like to tell our listeners more about the Patreon page and also your idea to travel across America to change hearts and minds at college campuses?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of what we've been doing with the pigs prior to Beatrice coming. was going to college campuses, and we usually try to contact a local group of like vegans or animal rights activists there. And then we'll hand out leaflets and get college students to meet the pigs. So essentially what we do here at Colonial Williamsburg, but just on college campuses, knowing that, you know, that's probably our number one audience in terms of most likely to change, you know, and make those choices right away. Like, my wife is awesome. She, you know, allows me to eat and have a place to sleep and, you know, covers all my existence. And so it's mostly just when it comes to activism, you know, being able to afford the gas to get places, you know, printing leaflets, you know, it's like, I'm always trying to cut costs, but sometimes like stuff like printing the leaflet in color, you know, like there's a reason why I think PETA and Mercy for Animals and all those groups print them in color is because, you know, it's more appealing. People are going to pay attention to it more. And so having those leaflets that we're working on be in color and, you know, have, you know, a nicer look to them is hopefully going to make more people pay attention, read it, and then change. And so it's costs like that. It's nice to be able to fund through something like Patreon. It's never going towards like us going on vacation or anything like that, because I can't handle vacations. That's when I go into my dark place, because I don't have, you know, as much to do, and that gives me time to think. So that's what the Patreon is about. Is about making it so I can do more activism and do it more effectively, because, you know, I do it for free and I do it without any resources, and, you know, I just know I'd be less effective. And so I've been so lucky to have so many people support a lot of what I've done in terms of getting the equipment that I need, or, you know, funding, you know, trips to different places to go do activism. And so the more people do that, the more effective I am. And so I know, you know, that I'm probably like 100 times more effective just as a result of having people support it rather than spending time, you know, whether it be getting a job or, you know, trying to do more artwork or something to pay for what I do, because then I end up spending half my time doing that and then half my time probably more tired but still trying to do the activism versus just being out there and getting the message out to as many people as I can.
Well, Ryan, you are also a very creative person. You're an artist and you make music. You produced the cartoon called The Carnies, which I didn't even know that was you until I read it yesterday. And I had posted one of your recent videos without even knowing it was you. I'd love it if you could tell us about your artwork and how people can see or buy it. Your artwork is just beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I the first episode of The Carnies I wrote, and it was like a 10-minute, like actual, almost like South Park-y episode. And so I had a few people say, yeah, put that under a different thing and don't tell anyone that it's you. And so it's, you know, like I sort of understand, and it's like the South Park component of my personality. Like I love that type of humor that takes things like 10 steps beyond where you should. But it makes the point that you can't really make if you're just, you know, if you just try to say to someone, hey, this is bad, versus you make it so absurd that people see it. And so that's what The Carnies is to try to take South Park and make it vegan. And then, the Life with Pigs webpage, lifewithpigs.com, I post all the artwork that I paint, which is usually just like to fund stuff, like with Beatrice's implant, you know, the doctor has to get two of them at once and it's $700. So just to fundraise stuff like that, you know, it helps if I can sell some art to, you know, cover those costs. And so I post a lot of that there. And then like one thing I'm trying to work on now, and I've been meaning to forever, but I want to create sort of I've never read comic books, so I'm the worst person to do this, but sort of a superhero like pig or something like that. Like I'm thinking like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle type story where they somehow become morphed a bit and then try to help animals. Because I think that's another part of The Carnies, is to try to get a younger audience who, you know, might be laughing at bacon jokes one minute, but then see something like The Carnies and laugh at it and then realize that they're actually laughing at like their own, you know, bad choices or cruelty. And so,
right.
And I mean, anything I can do art wise, you know, like we wrote the book about Anita. I feel like I'm sure there's a bazillion things I'm forgetting.
Is that Anita Crimes?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Can you maybe tell our listeners a bit about that? We've had her on the show before, but for people who are maybe just tuning in for the first time.
Yeah. So the story is basically around when she gave water to the pigs up in Canada, and then they tried to put her in jail for 10 years, saying that, you know, she had criminal mischief, tampering with their goods, and, you know, I mean, it was absurd. But so what I did is I took it and I turned it into a Dr. Seuss rhyme, and then just did some illustrations to sort of tell the story of, you know, here's this person that cares about animals, wants to, you know, do good by them. And then the other side is these people who want to put you in jail for caring because they just want to make a profit. And it does end happily with the bad guys deciding to, like, start a sanctuary and stuff, you know. So it tries to not make them, you know, the wow. deep dark, which I think, you know, is in large part Anita wanted that. I don't think she in any way wants to, like, make anyone seem evil. So
Anita's a very sweet, kind person.
She is. Yeah.
She's also a gift to the animals, as are you. Now, we're going to be ending the show with a song called A Call to Stand Up for Pigs. And you wrote this song, and I was watching the video to go with it on YouTube yesterday. It really struck me. You were mentioning the Pig Save vigils before, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about the meaning behind the song and the video that goes with it.
I never really know what I call them officially, so, but if it's the Rise Up, Shut Them Down song, like, it went along with, like, we, on February 1st, we all went to, like, 300 people, maybe 200 people, somewhere around there, went to Tar Hill, North Carolina, which is the largest pig slaughtering facility in the country, I believe. And so it was about the experience of being there and just how backwards things are. Like, in terms of the police bullying people, shoving us around, and they wouldn't look at the trucks, they wouldn't acknowledge what was happening, and it was clear a lot of them had been either paid by Smithfield to be there or worked for Smithfield in the capacity of pig farmers as, like, their side job, you know, to being a police officer. And so just seeing how, like, everything down there is run by Smithfield, they, you know, control so much of the state of North Carolina. And so wanting it to be like this song that sort of tells the story of what's happening to the pigs, but also telling the story of just how, in a lot of ways, North Carolina is not very different than they were in, say, 1850, when you had a whole different group of corrupt people running the state, you know, for other, you know, evil reasons. And so it's hoping that people, you know, especially in North Carolina, will finally say, hey, we don't want these people running things anymore, just because they always have and they have the money. Maybe we should take things back and change things, and then hopefully getting people to realize that the pigs, you know, don't deserve to be a part of this in any way.
Right. And you probably saw in the news this past week that the people of North Carolina have actually sued Smithfield, and Smithfield is being ordered to pay them millions of dollars for basically the inconvenience of the factory farm being right there in the area with health problems and noise from the trucks and that. So,
yeah, a lot of, and it's sad too to read those things, because I know a lot of it's like the pig farms, what they'll do is to get rid of the lagoons of pig poo, will spray it into the air and it lands on people's houses, you know, like they end up in their lungs. And then the state of North Carolina, the politicians have passed laws to limit how much the people can get from the pig farms. And so, like, they'll say, oh, they've been sued for $425 million, and then it drops down to like 100 or, you know, less. Because the state, the officials are so, you know, either one, they actually work for Smithfield or are part of it, or two, they're paid by Smithfield to, you know, keep things in their favor. And so, because right after the first court case, you saw they passed a new law saying that you can't, you know, sue them for any of these things, and anything that's happening that's a standard practice is okay. And, you know, like, all these things to protect the company against the citizens that they're supposed to protect. It's hard to understand that we live in a world where that's possible, because we think that's only something that happens in the past or in movies. But it's clear that, you know, the people of North Carolina are not a priority to the politicians of North Carolina. So, yeah, it's depressing when you read about North Carolina. It's a very backward situation for sure.
Well, maybe we can end on a more positive note. So let's try to think of that. To end the show, is there something positive that you would like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are changing. And I still believe that in a very, very short time, we could go from feeling like this is going to take forever to how do we end up with it all happening? Because You know, no one in 1860 thought slavery is going to be gone, you know, within 5 years. Like, there's probably not a person alive that even dreamed that. You know, most optimistic person alive didn't think that. And so I think we have to keep that in mind, because things are changing so rapidly. And it's not like, you know, any other social justice movement in the past had sort of a real swell of support going into things changing. It usually was, you never think it's going to change, and then all of a sudden you can't remember how it was ever, you know, not changed. And so I really think that we're going to see just this explosion of, you know, vegan, you know, ideas and morality just spreading throughout the consciousness of the world. And we're going to wonder, you know, why do we have to do anything? Why are we fighting so hard? This seems so easy. But of course, I think, you know, that's because there's so many people out there fighting so hard to change things.
And if we can live happy and healthy lives without harming others, why wouldn't we, right? So thank you so much for introducing us to Beatrice and Pumpkin earlier, and for just coming on the show today to speak about your micro sanctuary, Life with Three Pigs, a Chicken, and a Rabbit, and about how you do daily activism to reach the hearts and minds of both children and adults. To find out more about Ryan's activism, you can visit lifewithpigs.com and also like the page Life with Pigs on Facebook. Also, if you'd like to make a donation to support Ryan's efforts, please visit his Patreon page at patreon.com/threelittlepigs. Thank you so much, Ryan, for your time today. I appreciate it so much.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me on. This is great.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. I also wanted to announce that this just came in a few minutes ago from my sister via Biff Naked's Instagram. She has announced that one of our favorite animals in Vancouver, Canuck the Crow, who you might know from one of our previous shows, he has just been voted Metro Vancouver's unofficial ambassador. If you don't know who Canuck the Crow is, check out the film Canuck and I on YouTube, and you can check out our interview with Canuck's best humans friend Sean Bergman on animalvoices.org. Please join us on our next show. That's next Friday, August the 24th. And as we spoke about earlier, today's closing song is called A Call to Stand Up for Pigs, the Rise Up Shut It Down anthem, written and performed by today's feature guest Ryan Phillips. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Loaded on the trucks, headed to town. The first damn time they've seen the sky. You try to close your eyes, but you can't deny the sadness in their eyes. And there's someone inside. You say you don't care, but I know you lied. You try to make believe away the truth you can't hide. Carolina police try to shove us back. They violate our rights and violently attack. I stand.